Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Rake. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly.
Dr. Keith Scott Mumby with us. He is a medical doctor. He's also the author of Cancer Research Secrets, Therapies That Work and Those That Don't, A New Understanding of How Cancer Grows and Feeds on Itself. He's qualified as a doctor in the UK in 1970, the British equivalent degree in the MD and our Bachelors of Medicine and Bachelors of Surgery. He later obtained an international MD and a PhD at the Open International University of Complementary Medicine. He's been at the forefront of advances in medicine for almost 40 years now, and he was among the original pioneers of the clinical ecology movement. In the 1980s, he made medical legal history when a UK Crown Court accepted his evidence that food allergy could make a youth murderously violent. And he's been dubbed the world's number one allergy detective. Let us say, Keith, I welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much. When we are dealing with cancer treatments that work, cancer treatments that don't work, I think Steve Jobs is a great example. I am a complete believer in alternative medicine, and I really also believe that that allopathic medicine in certain spots do it. There are some people who need chemotherapy, some people who need radiation, some people don't. But I think with Steve Jobs, he waited too long. And by the time he waited using the alternative methods, he ended up dying. So when somebody gets cancer, which is a very scary thing that anybody would be diagnosed with, Keith, what's the first thing? Where do you go? Where's the first step?
Well, listen, Michael, the first thing I say to them is, look, cancer is not a death knell, but it is a wake-up call. It's telling you your health is in ruins and you're going to have to do something. So people that don't change their diet and lifestyle, they're really playing with very dangerous material here. You know, cancer's pretty scary, as you say. But, you know, it can be beaten. And as we get more understanding of how these things work, it gets easier. We don't know all the causes, but we know something about the causes. You know, there's a genetic element.
Sure.
The World Cancer Research Foundation reckons that 40% of cancers have a dietary element. Some of us are very struck by the fact that there's often an emotional element. You know, there's a certain kind of person that might get cancer. As I say, perhaps all these are true, but this new theory is based on an older theory. In fact, it's not even a theory. It was practical. It was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1931, which is that cancer seems to be something that gets going in a low oxygen environment. So maybe, you know, if we upped the oxygen ante, as it were, this might help drive it off too. All of these theories are fascinating. You know, I've had a saying for years, Michael, that when we understand cancer, we'll understand health a lot better.
Sure.
And we're sort of inching our way closer, but, you know, it's a long way to go. It is a very scary and difficult disease, but the person has to have control for themselves. That's where I begin. You know, if the person just says, fix me to the oncologist, ain't going to work, because one of the personality types we know do well, the real ornery kind of character, you know, that just says, oh, screw you, you know, I'm not following what you say, I've got my own agenda, and yeah, yeah, yeah. That person seems to do very well, whereas the yes sir, no sir type personality doesn't do so good. So, you know, we have a lot to learn, but taking control of your own disease is the absolute starting point, which is what you asked about.
Okay, let me ask you this, and I'm not a clinician, so let me give you a breakdown of what I've learned cancer is, and stop me if I'm wrong. Basically, everybody's born with cancer cells. When you're born, it's something that is normal to the human body. what happens when the immune system's job is to fight off foreign bodies. Well, cancer is not foreign. So if the immune system doesn't recognize it, those cells begin to proliferate. And by the time that you recognize them, there's problems because now there's tumors and so on and so forth. So what I understand is that the immune system doesn't recognize them. That's what causes the problem because it's not something the immune system would fight.
Right. Well, you hit on two very important truths there, Michael, which is that the immune system is our number one defense. And, you know, in a sense, cancer is a disease of the immune system. But you also hit on another important point, which I have to make, and even oncologists don't think of this. You know, the cancer, the tumor, is basically you. You know, I have to say, you know, it wasn't something that was dropped into your body from outer space. It is you and your tissues that have gone wrong. So that, in its sense, contains a lot of hope. You know, this can be reverted. Your own cells can go back to normal. And it's not always just spontaneous regression or, you know, these terms that are used. Sometimes it's a plan. You know, by doing the right things, you can get back on track and your body recovers. But somehow or other, the immune system is absolutely vital to the story, as you say. We do have these cancer cells flying around all the time.
Yeah, let me give you a prime example, and I want to stay with issue. I don't want to focus on me. 14 years ago, they diagnosed me with stage 3B lung cancer. That said, I'm sitting on my – I knew I had to get an operation, so I'm sitting on my bicycle. I've been running around the hills getting in the greatest shape I could to get the operation. So I'm sitting on my bicycle, the stationary, and I'm pumping away, Keith, and I'm sweating. And then all of a sudden it hit me. I had one of those epiphany-type moments. I said it was okay to die. I didn't say I want to die. I said it was okay to die. The minute I said it was okay, it took the pressure off. And I really believe in my heart of hearts that at that moment in time, I allowed my immune system to kick in.
Well, we do know the immune system is absolutely hand in glove with your emotions. You know, if your emotions are screwed up, your immune system is screwed up. It's that simple. So you made a great decision there. And I compliment you. What you did was took away the emotional pressure. The immune system came up, and then, you know, it won the battle for you. This is a great story, that.
Yeah, no question. And I'm one of the kind. I'm living proof of what you just said a moment ago. They said to me, "You have cancer," and I said, "How do you fix it?" And they said, "Take chemotherapy and radiation." And I said, "No, next." And I'm still here. So.
You know, I do respect a person's right to choose. There are some alternative and holistic practitioners that get, you know, almost semi-hysterical if somebody wants to take chemo. It's the person's choice, but, you know, I wouldn't choose it, and I'm glad you didn't choose it. Yeah. But, you know, if a person does, then using sensible alternative measures like good nutrition can often protect the person from the worst, you know, negative effects of chemo. I've seen that happen so many times. I'm sure about that.
Wait, were you familiar with Virginia Livingston?
I'm not actually. No, I'm sorry.
Okay, the Livingston Foundation Medical Clinic, which was in San Diego, it's not there anymore. She passed away years ago, but they did the alternative. No chemo, no radiation, and just exactly what you were talking about. A lot of vitamin C, a lot of vitamin C IVs, a lot of carrot juice, and absolute nutrition. And basically what they did was immunotherapy. They just used your own body to clean up what was inside. And obviously I'm living proof. I'm here. But the point of contention is everything you're saying is spot on, because everything you're talking about, you're sitting across the microphone from it.
Exactly. Well, you're a living example, so, you know, you walk your talk. That's great. You know, Michael, I have a saying which I sometimes joke of the three rules, you know. Any good health measure is an anti-cancer measure. You know, rule two, any good health measure is an anti-cancer measure, and so on, you know, rule three. But it's true. What you're saying is absolutely. If you do anything to improve your health, you're going to help the cancer. And if you do enough to improve health issues, you can beat the cancer. And that seems to me to be how simple it is. You know, like it's almost lazy to just recommend the chemo route or radiation therapy and surgery. There are so many things that we can do now as we understand it better.
Now, by the way, there was someone in Texas, and I can't remember his name. It slipped. He's a medical doctor, but he was actually
going to... Brzezinski.
Say again?
Dr. Brzezinski, surely. The FDA were going to wipe him out, and then the FDA with him, and then he's getting funding, and then he's getting attacked. I thought you meant Dr. Brzezinski. Never mind.
There was another one. What he was doing, this was years ago, he's probably still around. Keith, he was getting rid of the tumors through imagery, through guided imagery. And it was actually working.
Oh,
was,
okay. Yeah. Gosh, I forgot. Yeah. I know who you mean.
Yeah.
Simonton. Carl Simonton.
Right. Carl Simonton. Yeah. That's who it was. Yeah. And so there's so many alternatives that thank God there are guys like you around that say that just don't get chemo, don't just get radiation, because there are alternatives that work just as well, and in some cases better.
Yeah. Think it through. And as I said, back to my, top of the interview, it's your shout. You know, the person has to be responsible for their own health and, how they... In fact, I've said to patients many times, you'll appreciate this from what you did, Michael, but really cancer is kind of a career change. You have to take it seriously. You have to shift gear and go for it and really see this thing off before you can go back to living a normal life. If you don't make that significant shift, then you might well succumb.
Sure. No question. I believe cancer, from what I've experienced, it's a mindset if you want to get out of it. And the other side of that, too, is you need a support system. You need either a family support system or somebody who really knows. One of the things, Keith, that I noticed with somebody that does have cancer, and it happened to me, I scared people. You know, I was always in great physical condition, and when they brought me home from the hospital, they wheeled me home in a wheelchair, and people saw me, and it scared them. So there is an emotional adjustment that has to be made when you go through this stuff.
Well, isn't it sad that, so much cancer, people are exposed to it through the lives of celebrities. They see it in the press, and they see the person deteriorating, and it's notorious that celebrities don't look after themselves. They don't know what to do. The whole lifestyle is wrong anyway, and then they just fade in front of people. So that's one of the reasons people get terrified of cancer. These repetitive images of people like Steve Jobs and Patrick Swayze fading away, and it's so scary for them. But of course, you never see the other story. The people who are blooming well, and you must know there are people who are even blessed the fact they got cancer because it pulled them out of it. Pulled them together and made them realize that they were way off track in life and just doing bad things. Whereas, once you've got the shock of having a cancer and you fix it, you're in a much stronger place than the average person that doesn't know, doesn't care, and doesn't understand their own health issues.
No question about it. One of the things that I did see, which left a very important impact with me, there was an oncologist that I saw when I came back to town, and I was living in Fairbanks, Alaska at the time. I was in the interior. And he said, without chemotherapy and radiation, you're going to die. And I said, yeah, right. And I saw him 5 years later. I'm at the airport, and I waved at him, and I said, hey, so-and-so, how are you? I said, look, I'm still here 5 years later. It was interesting, Keith. He looked at me like he was disappointed because he was wrong. That's scary.
You're right, though. I don't know why I'm laughing. I mean, it's kind of scary, horrible, isn't it? But, yeah. Doctors do this stuff, Michael, and it's not a joke, actually. They say, oh, you're not going to last 6 months. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it does the patient no good. I'm sure it literally puts down patients that, they respect the doctor, and he says, oh, I'm going to die. So the patient very obligingly dies, and the doctor feels smug and vindicated, as you said. But, I heard a funny story the other day. I had dinner with a colleague, and we were talking about this very point. And she had a patient in who was diagnosed with cancer 20 years ago. And it was one of these stories, the doctor said, oh, you'd be lucky if you make it through 6 months. The funny part was the doctor's long dead and the patient's still alive. Yeah.
That's a good story. But I really believe in my heart of hearts, 90% of healing through this thing is mindset, understanding the things that you're talking about right now, the things that you've got in your book, because the old traditional methods in some cases work, but you hit on a very valuable point. Suggestive idea. If somebody says to you, you're going to die, and when you're in that condition and frightened, that suggestion is taken literally. It's taken right into that subconscious mind, and the subconscious mind will take it on as a goal to achieve. You take a suggestion like that, you might as well kiss it goodbye because you did.
Yeah, I sometimes suspect in my cynical moments that oncologists like to scare people on purpose. I've often said if I come back in another life, I think I'll be an oncologist. You get to meet people in maximum terror that can't make decisions for themselves. They will go with what you say, and it's like 500,000 if they go with you. So what a career. Of course, I wouldn't. I mean, I'm pretty cynical.
No, I hear
career,
you.
No, that's a joke,
if, If there's anything to past lives, I want to come back as one of my dogs or one of my cats. That's the way to live. They breathe and you feed them. But when it comes down to it, we've got a couple, 3 minutes left. I want to make sure we get these valuable points out. And the pillars of cancer healing and going through those pillars, going through the process and understanding that for anything else, that just the idea that it's possible to make it through. And I think that's extremely important, not only for the cancer patient, but those people that are around that patient. Because it's not just one person that gets it. You get cancer, your entire family, quote unquote, symbolically has it, and you got to live with that.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, just for the listeners that don't know what my three pillars. I mean, you can pick your own, but my three are diet is very significant. A chemical cleansing. We live in a blizzard of chemicals, most of which are carcinogenic, and you need to get some of these out of your environment. And the third is an emotional detox, and that latter is probably the most significant of all. That speaks to what you were just saying. It's a mindset. If your mind is like you're ready for death, you may not make it. But if your mindset is I can fix this, I'm in charge, I've got care of my own health, then it can be beaten. So emotion is perhaps the most critical of the three, although the easiest to change is the diet one, the nutrition one.
Oh, absolutely, and there's no question about that. And then if we start to listen, because there's more and more people getting cancer today, and I don't know why, but it's starting to happen. But then again, too, if we look at the food and what we eat and all of those ingredients that cause this food to be able to last, for 4 years in a can, quote unquote, that we get a good reason why a lot of this occurs. Let me ask you this. We're about out of time. Keith, where can we find the book, and your website is what?
Well, first of all, I should mention my general, this is a freebie, vast information website, alternative-doctor.com, and doctor spelt in full, D-O-C-T-O-R, alternative-doctor.com. But this book is at cancerresearchsecrets.com, all one word, no dashes there, dots or dashes, cancerresearchsecrets.com. There's a little video there, we'll orient the person, and then they can decide what to do.
Wonderful. Hey, Keith, thank you so much for joining us tonight. That's great work because, again, I walk this walk, so everything that you're saying, if it wasn't true, I wouldn't be sitting here right now talking to you.
It's been a pleasure, Michael. Thank you very much.
Take care. Good night.
Night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Dennis Marcellino with us. He's the author of Addiction Free Forever, How to Permanently End an Alcohol or a Drug Problem. He's a former member of top bands, including Sly, the Family Stone, and the Elvin Bishop Group, Rubicon, and the Tokens, famous for The Lion Sleeps Tonight. We all know that one. And also as an internationally best-selling CD as a soloist artist. He participated in the alcohol and drug abuse in his industry for over 18 years, but hasn't touched anything for 29 years now. Dennis, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, and thank you so much for being here. Dennis, when we look at addiction today, addiction is addiction is addiction, whether it was 1950 or it was 2011 or 2012. People are brought to that. But one of the things that most people don't understand is we look at the artists, we look at the Hollywood personalities, they're making hundreds of millions of dollars and they're in and out of rehab all the time. Is there some kind of a common theme, an overarching theme that they run into, they fall into? What causes this?
Well, actually, I have an article where I say seven reasons why they do that. But it's, you know, primarily if somebody's good at music or good at whatever, they may not be good at having a good inner experience or dealing with what comes with fame. So celebrities have to always be on, and that's a problem. Unless a person is naturally feeling on all the time. But usually musicians get into music because they're filled with a certain emotion, and they find a certain style of music allows them to, you know, get that emotion out on a regular basis. But then at some point, you know, they may not feel it anymore. And so, but the show must go on.
No question about it. But 18 solid years of alcohol and drug abuse. Where was it, Dennis? Where was that light bulb that went on for you that said, okay, I'm done, this is enough? What caused you to really take a look at your life and stop?
Well, basically, I was, you know, I mean, drugs have kickers with them, too. I mean, you know, some people seem to think that they make you feel good all the time, but they don't. I mean, there's come downs and headaches and freak outs, you know, bad experiences and throwing up and all that. And so, but my initial draw is they made me peaceful. And so I had a question, well, why don't I just feel that way naturally? Why don't I feel that way all the time? So I realized that, well, I'm not going to find the answer to that question if I keep trying to use drugs and alcohol to run away from whatever I was running away from emotionally. So I just stopped and I started searching. And, it, you know, when I stopped, I did experience like an upheaval of like pain and anger and fear. And so I took that to wherever I could find out, how do I get rid of those feelings and how do I feel, quote unquote, high naturally?
It's got to be tough to be able to decide not to do it. Your body is an electrochemical factory. You know, you drink, you do drugs for 18 years. Your body's used to a certain amount of things that go into that body to cause it to work. The other thing is there's something called, there's a chemical called dopamine. It's the feel-good drug that the brain shoots out. Well, a lot of people who get addicted to narcotics, to alcohol, they don't have that sufficient creation of the dopamine. So what do drugs and alcohol do? They replace what your body isn't normally making. So you run into a situation where you're really, your body works in a certain way, your mind works in a certain way, the chemistry works in a certain way, and all of a sudden you stop. That has got to be tough.
Well, I mean, I call that thing that you just described, I call that stolen euphoria. In other words, when you steal something, you have to pay a price at some point, so and what goes up must come down. Yeah. And so that coming down is like a constant annoyance, you know, throughout drug and alcohol use. So yeah, that's what you want to get rid of. And see, a real problem, I think, in the country is that people don't have hope that there is a solution. You know, they think, well, I'm just going to stop the only way that I've come to conclude that makes me feel good. Why should I do that? And so the phrase that I kind of made up for that is that you can't expect people to say no to drugs until they're pretty confident that they have something better to say yes to. So that's what I do with my program. I give them that confidence, and I show them that, yes, there is a better way, and that you'll overall feel better all the time. And then I show people how to do that.
Okay. Now, by the way, when it comes down to it, if you take a look at it, 29 years that you've been cleaned up, and then 18 years doing it, that's 47 years, and it was probably 15, 20 when you started. So if you're up around 55, 60 years old, somewhere in there, you came from a world that, yeah, you could get a hold of drugs and alcohol, but not like these kids can get a hold of it today. And the potency and the power of what these kids are using today has got to be very tough. So you're coming around just about the right time, and maybe in another way to look at it, thank goodness that happened to you because of the lives you can touch to help people get away from that. Because the ability to get addicted today, I think, is far greater than it was when you first started out.
Well, yeah, the drugs today are really bad. And like you said, they're really potent. And I mean, what has to be looked at is, why would somebody take something, or even drinking? I mean, when you start drinking, it burns. It does not. It's not a pleasant experience. But then you like the high, and there's a lot of peer pressure involved usually too. But there must be something wrong in a person's life where they'll override that initial resistance to wanting to take things that are so harsh and even, you know, deadly. They're risking death. That shows kind of like, I think it's a reflection of where the society is at, even why the Occupy movement is happening. Yeah, I mean, people are spilling out into the streets. They're unhappy. They're unhappy with the society the way it is. And they don't understand it, though. I think that's what's going on. It's kind of like, I see them like fitting the movie title Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah.
And they know that they feel angry or bad or whatever, and so they spill out into the streets and find community with other people who are feeling that way. But I don't think they really understand why they're feeling bad. And so my program addresses that.
No question. Now, let's talk about the program in and of itself. How did you develop the program? How did you create the steps to take to be able to get someone to move past where they are?
Well, I developed the program just based on what solved it for me. When I first started to try to find a solution to the problem, like I described earlier, you know, why was I not feeling good naturally, and why was I feeling all these other things, you know, pain, anger, and fear. So I wanted to resolve that, and I just went to whoever could possibly have the answer, and it took me a long time to find the answer, though. And I went to a number of psychologists and psychiatrists and, you know, growth groups, and I didn't really find an answer, but I found bits and pieces along the way. And then, you know, I finally put all that together into a program. And what it really comes down to is just a person just accepting how they are, naturally. And you hear about the bullying thing as being a hot topic right now. Well, you know, our initial bullies might have been our older siblings and our parents, and when I grew up in the 50s, I used to get hit at school, not by the kids, but by the teachers, and even nuns. I went to Catholic school for a little bit, and boys' deans. And so that's kind of like being trained to kind of like go along with how other people want you to be through pain. And then you come out of it like teenage, and you have this identity crisis. Well, who am I really? Well, my program shows a person how to resolve that identity crisis and be who they really are naturally. And then there's a way that our heart is built to give us strength and peace and deep fulfillment and purpose. But we have to go according to the rules of the heart. It's carved in stone, and, you know, we can't make up these rules. But society has made up rules that aren't in harmony with our heart.
And by the way, the public schools were like that too, not just the Catholic school. I do remember the paddle, and you didn't want to go into the vice principal's office or the coach's office. So, yeah, I was there. Been there, done that.
Yeah, I was there a lot.
I hear you. And there's so many kids today that ended up getting addicted. You said something interesting about the quote-unquote, the confusion, you know, the kids that are out in New York and they're yelling about Wall Street, they're not happy. But most of them, and you're right, they don't know what they're not happy about. And because of that, that leads to finding community somewhere. And I think a lot of these kids, and you mentioned the community, a lot of these kids, a lot of the people that are there are searching for the recognition, the acceptance of other people who think the same thing, whatever that is. That in and of itself gets them in trouble. There's not clarity with it. And I really truly believe if they got into sync and they really knew what the purpose is, whatever it is that they were there for, they could end up accomplishing something instead of doing more harm than good to what they're trying to accomplish.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, and that's like what I say, the rebel without a cause. You know, I think that was a good title for a movie at the time. But what's really the problem? What is really? Why are they really unhappy? I say that the reason is like I go back to this thing of being in harmony with our natural being. I say that the reason that they're unhappy is because of the morals of the society in terms of like male-female relationships, just the real basic stuff and inner peace. They haven't found inner peace. I mean, basically, God's been kicked out of the mainstream. So, and that's where I found inner peace. And so I think that's a big part of it.
No, absolutely. And there's a total disconnect. You know, we were brought up, you and I were brought up at the same time. And when we were brought up in a country that doesn't exist anymore today. It doesn't look like it is today. My feeling about it, my feeling about it is this. I happen to be Jewish. But when I went to high school and junior high school, we sang Christmas carols. We had Christmas trees. We did all the stuff there was. So for me, what they're doing is they're killing the, whoever they are killing the culture that we were brought up with. We had something to anchor to hang on to. They don't have anything to hang on to today. It's too confusing, and that's what causes the majority of the problems. The sex education in the schools, if you've listened recently, they want the fifth and sixth graders to learn about homosexuality, good, bad, or indifferent. It really doesn't matter, but is that really the place for them to learn about oral sex with braces and so on and so on? This is not the kind of society that you and I grew up in, and that in and of itself can cause a lot of confusion.
Well, yeah, I mean, the TV show Happy Days, that was accurately said. I don't think people realize. I mean, I feel very fortunate to have grown up in the 50s.
Yeah.
Because they were happy days. And, we started out with the Pledge of Allegiance and prayer in school and even in public school. And that kind of sets a nice tone. But, you know, if people want to realize the difference between what it was like in the 50s and what it's like now, just go back and listen to the music in the 50s and compare it to the music now. And if music is a spillover of what's in a person's heart or what it generally are in people's hearts, the popular music, the music back then was, there was a lot of happy music, a lot of silly music, a lot of romantic music. I mean, male-female was more about falling in love than having sex. And
sure.
So they're missing out now.
Do you remember Roll With Me Henry? Roll With Me Henry was early 50s, and then there was the big shock because it was too suggestive, so they changed it, and it became Rock With Me Henry.
Right.
Yeah, a long time. I graduated.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of... I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I graduated in 1960, so you and I got to be real close.
No, I'm 65.
Ah, okay, a baby. Wait, Radio Susie said he's closer to me. You're good. Okay, but I was there. And that was a world, and I remember in that world specifically that if there was a bedroom scene in the movies, 1 foot was on the floor, and that was the law. The cowboy at the end of the movie didn't kiss the horse. A girl, he kissed the horse, but that's the way it was.
Right, well, there was a thing called the Hays Code back then. I mean, that's a real good thing to look up, unlike on Wikipedia. The Hays Code, H-A-Y-S, because those are the rules that movies and television had to go by, and the music, too.
Yeah.
And it was nice. See, people were safe. That's what it comes down to. It's like when those rules were in place, people were safe. I mean, the 56 and 57 Bel Air Chevy, you didn't even need a key to start the car. And people didn't lock their house doors. People felt safe. And I don't think people realize a world that was like that.
No, I think you bring up a very interesting point, Dennis, because if you look at it, the one thing we grew up with, it didn't mean that there weren't things we weren't afraid of, but the one thing that we grew up with was without the kind of fear there is today. I grew up in Southern California. I grew up in a place where no one knew anybody with a gun. You weren't worried about somebody driving down the street and shooting you. It was a completely different world. And I really believe that the fear and the confusion and the lack of, you said it, community causes the kids to move into these directions. And adults, they got to hide it. They don't want to see it. They don't have answers.
Right, and it's not. It also was for the black communities. I mean, who were supposed to have been helped by all this liberation stuff? No, if you look at black communities back in the 50s, I mean, they dressed nice. The women were highly respected, and no drugs. I never even heard of drugs, actually, even up until the point I graduated in 65. You probably didn't either when you were in high school.
When I was in the 11th grade, marijuana just became acceptable. I mean, that was it. That was the worst drug anybody could get a hold of. But I didn't inhale, so I have no idea what it was about. but it's true. It wasn't drug-oriented. I think the worst thing we used to do is somebody would go out and buy a couple of quarts of beer, and everybody would run around and act drunk and have a great time.
Right. That's true. That's as bad as it got. And I think a lot of that, too, I mean, being that the 50s weren't perfect, as we're saying, you know, we did get hit a lot, from the boys' deans. Even there was a boys' dean at the school that I was at who was so sadistic about hitting the kids that he punched holes in the paddle so as to stop the wind resistance. So it would hurt more.
I remember we had those too. Yeah. No, I got them.
There was a wild side to us too, which is how rock and roll came into being. And, you know, and that's a lot of what contributed to drinking then too.
Oh, sure. But I would change a word, and the word I would change between then and now, when we got into trouble, we didn't get into trouble. We got into mischief. These kids today get into trouble.
Right.
There's a difference between the two. Dennis, we're starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at, find the book at, and get more information about the program.
AddictionFreeForever.com.
Okay, it's Addiction Free
Forever. It's the only program out there that guarantees permanent resolution of any kind of addiction problem. And it's inexpensive, too.
Wonderful. Hey, Dennis, thank you so much for the work you're doing and being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Okay, good night.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you look on from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Jim Johnson with us. Coach Jim Johnson is with us. He's the author of A Coach and a Miracle, Life Lessons from a Man Who Believed in an Autistic boy. He's a veteran of a boys basketball coach at Greece Athena High School. He has won 300-plus games, 7 championships, 3 Section 5 titles. He's appeared on numerous national programs, including Good Morning America, CNN, and is a professional motivational speaker. And then, he's the co-author of A Coach and a Miracle. Jim Hay, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. A Coach and a Miracle. You've got a very special story. Let's begin and start with that story as a base, and we can move forward. Where did this begin for you?
Well, this began, I had a young man named Jason McElwain that now a lot of the world knows as J-Mac, and he came to our program in the 2003-2004 season. And he is autistic and also learning disabled. And Jason had a dream. His dream was that he wanted to make our basketball team and get into a game. And unfortunately, his sophomore year, he tried out for our JVs. I'm the varsity coach and did not make the team. But he was named the team manager for the JVs and really became a big, strong part of our program. The kids really developed a great relationship with him. So he came out his junior now for the varsity of the team I coached. And what made Jason unique to me was that he invested a lot of his own time to try to make the team. He came to a lot of our off-season workouts and camps and leagues and all that good stuff. And so his junior, he came out for the varsity team. And unfortunately, he was still not quite good enough to be on the team, but I offered him the varsity team manager's job. And he really kind of started to establish a mantra, because I had been a fairly successful coach, but I had like a big stumbling block. Kind of the big thing in our area is to win the Section 5 championship. And we had gotten close. We had gotten to the sectional semifinals 5 times. And Jason's junior, we ended up losing in the sectional semifinal for the 6th time on a buzzer beater. So we were pretty devastated. But Jane Mack never gave up on his dream or his other dream to help us win the Section 5 championship. So his senior year, he came back out for the team, again investing a lot of his own time. And when he went through tryouts, this time I brought him in and I told him, unfortunately, he was not quite good enough to be on the team. I mean, you could see some real disappointment, but I said to him that for your loyalty and commitment to our program, I want to give you a gift. And his head popped back up and he said, well, what's your gift, coach? He goes, well, for senior night, I'm going to give you a chance to get in uniform and hopefully get you in the game. And he was pretty fired up. In fact, I kid people that he would periodically ask me about that uniform, and I define periodically as about every other day. Yeah. So he finally got his opportunity on February 15th. It was our senior night, and with just over 4 minutes to go, his dream came true. I put him in his first varsity basketball game, and he missed his first shot by a mile. He shot a 3-pointer and it wasn't even close. And then he got a second shot, which was a much closer shot, and it almost went in, but didn't. It fell off the rim. But the third shot was magic. He made a 3-pointer, and I said to myself, oh my gosh, God must be a basketball fan. Not only did Jason get a basket, but he made a 3-pointer. Can't get any better than that. And then, unbelievably, he turned into Michael Jordan for like 3 minutes, and he ended up making 6 3-pointers and another 2-pointer that actually his foot was on the line. So he actually scored 20 points in less than 4 minutes of the game, which if he played the whole game, that would come out to 160, which would be a pretty amazing feat in itself. But 20 points in 4 minutes for any player at any level is an incredible feat. And then they add the fact it was Jason's only varsity game, and him being autistic and learning disabled just added to that. And it was just, from my coaching perspective, it was the most special night I've ever had in coaching. And then put the cherry on top for that season, we ended up going on and winning our first Section 5 championship. And Jason has since come back to our program, and he's been a volunteer assistant for the last 3 seasons. We've won 2 more, so we've actually won 3 sectional championships in total. So it was certainly a very memorable night, and we learned so much. And the book shares that. It talks a lot about the interesting thing about that season is I had my absolute low, which we delve into. I had a lot of parental issues where I nearly resigned early in the season. And then, you know, going through the season, we rebounded and got the team back together and went on this nice streak and ended up having Jason's special night and really even made the team stronger, and then went on and won the sectional championship. So it was such emotional highs and lows, and I just had so many life lessons that I learned through that year that I wanted to share in the book, not only from that season, but in my many years of coaching. I wanted to share the experiences that I think I could help people with.
Jim, a couple of things. One is, and I'm not a clinician, but autism. I've done a tremendous amount of interviews on autism over the years. And the one thing that stands out for me, the one thing that I remember, that if some of these kids with autism, if you go through that autism, there is a something that they're genius about, something that they're very special about. But you got to be able to break through to get to that. And obviously, you found it in him. But in him, what is in him that you saw that broke your chains?
I think that for me personally, it was his passion. That's one of the things I talk about. I do a lot of public speaking, and I think that's where it all starts, is he just had such a love for basketball, and I think that was like his special, although he was not super gifted as a basketball player, but he was very gifted in the fact that he had such a love for the game and really has become a student of the game and knew a lot about all the teams in our league. And so that's what really came to me, was that he was so passionate, and he so much wanted to help our team win the sectional championship. So he was such a great team player, which is another one of the things I talk about in my speeches as well as my book. And I think those were the two things that really jumped out to me. And, you know, in an own special way, whether you believe in a God or another higher power, I really believe there was a calling there for me and Jason, that because of the prevalence of autism right now, and a lot of people are lacking hope, and I think it gave a lot of people hope, and we've gotten so many letters. In fact, I got an email that was sent to the school I taught to our principal yesterday, and this is over 5 years that somebody just saw the video on YouTube and was so touched that they wanted to reach out to us. So this story has really been something that's given a lot of hope and inspiration to not only people in the autism community, but people, you know, with any kind of disability, or people that just right now are having some difficulty with hope. And I think it's given hope and inspiration to so many.
Jim, did they, by chance, you're talking and I'm seeing this in my head, was there a movie, something similar to this?
Well, we're actually hopefully going to see this as a movie someday. The one movie I kind of compare this to, although the gentleman was not autistic or learning disabled, but was the Rudy story, you know, where he went to Notre Dame and actually got a chance to get into the game.
Okay. I know there was something similar somewhere within that. And I think it would be an absolute great story. But when we're dealing with leadership, what element of leadership did you get out of this? What was that certain grounding, that specialness that came out of the story of the two of you that you could apply to leadership?
Well, I think the one thing that we've developed that I think is so essential in leadership is building trust. And that's the one thing that, as Jason and I have grown together, you know, and actually have grown even stronger together since that season, you know, as assistant coach on my staff now. But the fact that we just really can count on each other, and we are really on the same page, then in leadership, to me, I think, you know, it all starts with you having a real vision and understanding what your purpose is. And, you know, for me, my mission is to be an outstanding role model that makes a positive difference in the world by helping others make their dreams come true. And that's something that, you know, I'm so proud that I was able to help Jason have his dream come true. But the thing that really jumped out, you know, with Jason was that I had so much trust in him. I could count on him, and he was so into, you know, helping us that I wanted to help him.
You know, when you come down to it, one of the messages that I'm hearing here loud and clear is that never say you can't. You know, there are so many people who could have. Maybe it was just the one time. Who could have? That didn't, and have to live their life that way. Give them the opportunity. Take the shot. And if you can do it, you do it. And if you don't, at least you participated.
Absolutely. You know, two of the other things I talk about, because a lot of my keynotes, I talk about how to make your dreams come true. And two things that you really touched on that jump right out at me is number one, is perseverance. I know of no one that's been successful that doesn't have that trait very strong, where they, you know, that never give up attitude. And, you know, Jason was a great illustration to that. And along the same lines, one of the other things I talk about is carpe diem, which seize the day. And I break carpe diem into two components, and that would be, number one, in having a great work ethic, and number two, having a positive attitude. And, you know, when I share with audiences, I always talk about, you know, attitudes are infectious, is yours worth catching? And J. Maxwell always was, and, you know, that's one of the things I really try to come in every day, is to have an attitude that's going to be a positive infection on our team and not a negative infection, or, you know, when I'm talking to audiences or being around people. And, you know, the other thing I always am talking to young people, because I've been a teacher and coach for over 30 years now, and then what I share with audiences is to be exceptional, I think you have to be outstanding in the things you can control, and you can control how hard you work, and you can also control your attitude. And I think those are the messages that come out, you know, to help people make their dreams come true, is think about the things you can control and be as good as you can in those areas.
The other side of this, and why I think sports is so critically important, when I was in high school, I ran track, I played football, and but the interesting thing was this. Some of the things, and I went into the service right after high school, but some of the things that I learned in football, some of the things I learned running track, what I learned in the service, it was something called a discipline. And I think that in and of itself is something that we're missing with a lot of the kids today. They're taking sports away from, you know, you don't get that gym time that you normally used to get when I was in high school 150 years ago.
Right.
But the point is, they missed the team spirit, the camaraderie, that point even, and thank God I didn't have to go to combat. I was too young for Korea, and I was too old by the time Nam came around. I was in and out. And I would have gone, but thank goodness I didn't have to go. But the point was that, and the same thing with a team, playing football, doing something, playing basketball, that guy behind you, that guy watching your back, the one that's got your back, it doesn't matter what color he is. It doesn't matter what ethnicity, what religion, whatever it is. That's a teammate.
Right.
And that's one of the things that we've lost in transition here.
I totally agree. One of the things, my life studies is, you know, what makes people successful. I know one of the things that jumped right out of my study is the fact that people that have success have greater self-discipline. And then to take it this step further, what you were sharing about a team is that I think when you know, the famous word synergy, and the fact that, you know, the whole is stronger than the sum of the parts, and we see that so much in sports where, you know, we see one team that appears to have more individual talent, but the other team wins because of their fact that their synergy and they're so together. And I think that's the essence of what team is all about, is that, you know, you build that camaraderie, you build that trust in each other, and it's so neat to see when you see a group of individuals that, you know, I think to be successful, you certainly have to have talent. You know, you can't be, you know, terrible in your particular endeavor and do that. But if your skill level is pretty good and your synergy and your team is together, you can go so much further than if your talent is really good, but you're not together and you don't trust each other. You know, those teams tend to usually falling in the end because they, you know, when the chips go down, they're not supporting each other, as opposed to that team that is really together and really is looking out for each other.
You just talked about the base for doing business today. Your major corporations, your smaller businesses, your Fortune 500 companies, and so on and so forth. It's the exact same process that would keep a business together, that'll keep a team together. If you don't have the team, you have nothing. And let's bring it right back to the family. If you do not have the team in the family, you absolutely have nothing. That place to be accepted, that place where you gain identity. And through sports, there's a lot of kids that don't have an identity, that they can foster an identity through that particular sport and really become something of themselves. And when it's time to stop playing the sport, they take it onto their relationships, they take it onto the businesses, and so on and so forth. So absolutely, team is critically important.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And I think it's just, you know, the one thing I think with some, I think the family structure is something that's, you know, something we have to constantly work on right now. And I think as a teacher and coach in my role, I think I've taken a bigger role where I've become that surrogate parent, for lack of better words, and trying to teach the people. And I think for a lot of kids, it's a haven to go to be able to be part of a team and be accepted and appreciated. And as, unfortunately, a lot of times it's not happening in the family structure. But those experiences they can get from being a part of a team that is together, I think, is so powerful in them going forward and being successful in all their endeavors in life. So
no question
about
it.
You learn so much from being on a team. The fact that you go through wins together, you go through losses together, you go through ups and downs, and that's what life's all about. It's a microcosm of what life is.
And by the way, I don't think you lose. If you play, if you lose, and I think this is the old philosophy. It's the philosophy that drove people forward and to get better. Good. You should lose every once in a while. And then what that does, it allows you to get better. Not the way they're doing it today for the most part. Everybody gets a badge. You played, you're number one.
Right.
No. You got a team. Somebody wins, somebody loses. And if you lose, what does that mean? Doesn't mean you're bad. It means go get better.
Absolutely. I think one of the philosophies I share with our kids is, failure isn't a person, it's an event. But, I think the greatest thing we always talk about is an opportunity to improve, an opportunity to learn. And, unfortunately, as much as sometimes we don't want to admit it, but we usually learn so much more from a defeat because it really shows some things you have to work on. And the strong teams, they get better from that. The teams are really together and, really continue to push each other. I remember an illustration, actually the year that Jason came back and started helping our team was in 2008, 2009, and we had a very inexperienced team. I thought we had a chance to be good, but I wasn't sure. And we played in this early season tournament, and we got our clocks clean. We were down 38-6 at halftime. Well, that team, they really show what their character is about, because that season progressed. We really came together, and we ended up winning the sectionals again for the third time and ended up going further in the state tournament. And it was not my most talented team, but it might be the team that was most together and got the most out of their ability. But you have a great point. The fact that, we got absolutely shellacked by a team early in the season was a great learning experience, and those kids handled it very well and knew that they had a lot of work to do, and they did it. And that's a great tribute to that team.
Coach Jim Johnson, we're about out of time. Website we can find you at, find out about the workshops, and also buy the book.
Yes, I have two. My speaking and workshop website is CoachJimJohnson.com, and my book website is ACoachAndAMiracle.com, which is the name of the book. And I do keynote speeches both on dreams really do come true and leadership that makes your dreams come true. And I talk about teamwork as well. And I also have a workshop on leadership and, of course, a book. And then I have a DVD out now. A lot of people have asked me, do you have the original JMAC game on video? And I decided to do that. And so I have that available as well.
Just to finish it off, the one thing I remember about my coaches, and I remember their names, and it was a lot of years ago, that paddle with the holes in it. Boy, you were good. And thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Michael Ray. It was great.
Great. Take care. Good night.
You too. Good night.
You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. Gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're wrong. Yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sandy Morrow with us. We're going to be talking about the impacts of electromagnetic fields, EMFs, and she's the founder and the administrator of the EMF Safety Network website. She's been researching the health impacts of EMF since November 2006, when she discovered her health and immune system was compromised by EMFs from indoor wiring. She organized a successful campaign to defeat a citywide Wi-Fi installation, and in 2008 in Sebastopol, California, the EMF Safety Network started the campaign in California against the wireless PG&E smart meters in October 2009. On behalf of the EMF Safety Network, she filed an application with the California Public Utilities Commission, which is now in the appeal stage, and she coordinates efforts with activists throughout California, the U.S., and Canada. Sandy, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, very interesting when we talk about the EMFs. You know, we live in a world where, you know, everything's technologically advanced now, coordinated. Everybody's got something. You wire this. You don't have to do anything. You don't buy a car anymore. You buy a computer. You hit a button, and it takes you where you want to go. But what we're not realizing, and I don't know why they didn't look at this, there's a tremendous amount of hidden dangers, aren't there?
That's right,
So for yourself personally, what caused you to truly get involved in this?
About 5 years ago, I was trying to figure out what was going on with my health and my immune system. I was really having a lot of trouble with my health, a lot of recurring colds. I had pre-cancer that I needed to have removed, and my doctor at the time told me that I need to improve my immune system. And I'd already been doing acupuncture and chiropractic and Tibetan medicine and cranial sacral work, and I just couldn't figure out what was causing the stress. My acupuncturist told me I had the pulses of an old lady, and I'm not an old lady. And so I really didn't know. And I hired an EMF electrician to come test my house, because I had known that EMFs can affect the immune system from, you know, about 10, 15 years before then. I had my house tested for EMFs. It was in the 90s where they were talking about power line exposure can cause cancer. And so I had known this, so I had my house tested, but I thought that if you didn't have anything plugged in around your bed, you were pretty much okay, because it's those little boxes, you know, on the plugs, and they emit immediate EMF field, and so you didn't want to have anything like that or a digital clock by your bed. And we had nothing plugged in by our bed, but we had an EMF electrician come in and test our home and find out that based on indoor wiring, our house had really high electromagnetic fields. So I asked him if he thought that was the cause of my immune system problems, and he thought that possibly it was. So I asked him, what do I need to do? And he said that you need to reduce your exposure to the electric fields and magnetic fields in the home, turn the rest, figure out what the least you need in your home in terms of appliances, and turn the rest off at the breaker box. So I mapped out the house and figured out the least we needed, and then turned the rest off at the breaker box. So we started sleeping without electricity in our bedrooms right away. And the healing was so profound and dramatic. And I made a promise to myself that I wouldn't try any other technique to improve my health. I would just reduce my exposure. and it was really dramatic how quickly my immune system rebounded. And I made a promise to myself at the time that I would not talk about this, even though I was dying to tell people. It was such a shock that electricity could have such a profound effect. I mean, I was, before I had this, I was really bone tired. I probably had chronic fatigue. And so after this, my health really rebounded, and the tiredness went away. I was sleeping better, feeling better. A lot of my energy restored. And so then I made a promise to myself that I wouldn't go out and talk about this until I had researched it, because I wanted to feel that I was credible when I talked about it. I didn't want to just go out and say, "Oh my God, this is true. People need to reduce their exposure to electricity." And so I studied about it for a year, and that at the very 1 year date, our city in Sebastopol had voted to install citywide Wi-Fi, which is an EMF device. It's in the radio frequency field. But so I went to the council meeting and asked them not to do that after my year of study, and they went ahead and voted for it. But then we took the next 4 months to talk to them, and they ended up terminating a legal contract for this Wi-Fi, which created a lot of backlash, frankly.
Sandy, your biggest battle has got to be, not any way you look at this, is the money that some of these companies are going to start to lose if you start to win. That's got to be the biggest challenge to get through this. You know, when you really come down to it, you follow the money, you find out why somebody's doing what and so on and so forth. So you got an interesting battle.
Right, right. Well, it's just one foot in front of the other. I mean, if I had thought about that in terms of taking on PG&E like we did 2 years ago, I probably would have never started. I mean, you're right, there is so much money behind the wireless.
Oh, no question about it. Now, where do you think you'll go with it? Do you think that you truly have the ability to get what you want out of this? Can you stop it?
I believe we can. I believe that where we want to go is to reduce public exposures. That's where we want to go. And I believe that we can go there. I think we're getting, in one way, thanks to the smart meters, is bringing the issue to every home, in that every home is having a wireless device put on it, like it or not. Yeah, at least in California, this is so. And what we've done so far is that the Public Utilities Commission has now given us the right to opt out of it.
Oh, okay.
So it's a step in the right direction.
All right. So when you really come down to it, do you think that realistically, if you get this, if you win, what's the alternative for them? Do they have an option to do something whereby they can back out and say, okay, you win, but at the same time, they've got some place to move? Because if they have no option, there could be a major problem in you progressing with this.
I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
Okay, well, if you stop the Wi-Fi, if you stop the Wi-Fi program and they don't install, if it's stopped completely dead, do they have an alternative, another way to be able to create what a Wi-Fi can do for them?
Well, the Wi-Fi that we stopped in Sebastopol was basically an unnecessary one.
Oh, okay.
That wasn't in people's homes. I mean, it was just on the street, so you could get Wi-Fi on the street. You know what I'm saying? So that you can have wired internet. It doesn't stop the internet. You can have it wired. In fact, cell phones can get an internet now. And that was true back in 2008.
Oh, okay. So in essence, what you're really doing is you're stopping one of the services to bring that bring sound, bring everything to the house, but you're not stopping it altogether. You're letting the more safer programs be available to the homeowner there, and you're taking the service that's going to hurt somebody, and you're making sure that gets stopped and not wired into the house.
Right. What we're looking to do is reduce public exposures. And now that we have the World Health Organization has classified electromagnetic radio frequencies. This is also known as RF or wireless or microwaves. They've classified it as a class 2B carcinogen, which is a possible carcinogen, and that's the same classification as for DDT and lead. And this was based on studies from cell phone exposures, and cell phones emit radio frequencies, wireless microwaves. And so I believe it was 10 years on the same side of the head, you had an increased 40% increased risk of brain cancer from the radio frequencies. And so smart meters transmit pulsed radio frequencies.
Now, by the way, is there any recourse? Let's say, for instance, that somebody does get brain cancer, somebody does have an ill effect from this that's debilitating enough that that disables them or kills them. Is there any recourse? Can you go back to PG&E, one of the companies that was responsible for doing the wiring, et cetera, and putting the product in the homes? Is there recourse?
At this time, in terms of a lawsuit, because we are working with the Public Utilities Commission, and in California anyway, we have to exhaust our remedies there before we can take it to a into a lawsuit with PG&E. So right now we're in the appeal stage, and we will sue them if we don't win at the PUC.
Okay, so how do you feel about it? Do you feel you've got enough ammunition to do the job?
We have a discussion list online with over 100 members, and I think, you know, your earlier caller, I heard the tail end of that, and they were talking about teamwork.
Yeah.
And I think that as activists, I think that we could improve our teamwork and be more successful, and I think that's probably our next step to do. The EMF Safety Network is working mostly in California, although we do network and with other states. In the United States and Canada, British Columbia right now is working really hard to stop the smart meters there. But I think that if we as a group collectively could work better as a team, that we would be more successful.
Okay, but let's say, Sandy, I as the average person, what can I do to get involved, to become active, to make a dent in this?
Right. Well, The thing to do first for people is to understand what the problem is. The core of the problem is that smart meters are costing us money, privacy, or health and safety. That's the main problem with smart meters. And that utilities have rolled these out mainly to make money and to save money on meter reader jobs. And the whole smart grid is updating the grid using a lot of wireless technologies. However, it didn't have to be that way. They could have used fiber optics in the first place, but they didn't because it was cheaper to go wireless. So what people can do is, and also one of the really big problems is the skyrocketing utility bills. The meters are not measuring usage accurately. And another problem is that the meters are catching on fire. Mm. And I have all this documented on the website, the emfsafetynetwork.org. And so I recommend that first people come to the EMF Safety Network and to learn the problems. On the right-hand side of the website, I have a column called Most Popular. And the first five posts there, which would be smart meter health complaints, that's a compilation of all the health problems people are experiencing after smart meters are installed. And then the fires and explosions, the hazardous meters, and smart meter comments. And then there's one called spy meters, and that's about the privacy issues. So I recommend that people get familiar with what the problems are and then take action. And people need to be refusing these meters and not allowing them on their homes. And
in essence, if you know about it ahead of time, you can stop it before it happens.
Depends on how much time you have. There are places now I just heard in Vermont, they've gotten an opt-out because they didn't want to have happen what happened in California. So the utilities are agreeing to an opt-out immediately. Yeah, an opt-out doesn't totally solve the problem. It protects people who are educated, and it does not protect people who don't know. So if you're living and sleeping right next to one of these pulsing smart meters, you could be having all kinds of health problems and going to your doctors and getting on medicine. You don't know what's going on, and you could be getting very harmed and not know why because you're not educated. And the other problem is that the utilities and the regulators are allowing this, is they're charging people to opt out. For example, PG&E proposes to charge people hundreds of dollars per year just to opt out. So we are definitely opposing that. But so people, if they don't have the meters, if they don't have the, smart meter is one name for them. They could be called AMR meter, AMI meter. I've even heard they're called Earth meters. But they're all wireless devices, and they're transmitting pulse radiation, which is dangerous. So people need to, people can protect their analogs by locking it up, putting a sign next to it, but they need to contact the utility provider and their state regulator, if their utility is run by the state regulators. It's called the Public Utilities Commission. Most states have one.
Sandy, we're just about. Let me hold you up. I hate to do this to you. We're running out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at, and what to do if we want to get involved?
Yes, it's EMFSafetyNetwork.org.
Okay, EMF.
And the bigger picture, yes. EMFSafetyNetwork.org. And the bigger picture is that every day devices in our home are posing a health risk to us. Cell phones, Wi-Fi, deck phones, cordless phones. And people can learn to reduce and avoid and work to facilitate public policy change. So that's EMFSafetyNetwork.org. There's a lot of information on that website. If you look down the right-hand sidebar, you can see the most popular posts. And there's one other resource under resources. It's called EMF and RF World Concern Summary. You can find a lot of information there about what the world actions the world has taken in terms of recognizing the need to reduce public exposures.
Great. Hey, Sandy, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
And a long time can never score. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Well, that's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
I don't know how. I hope that she'll hear my plea.
Ken Armstrong with us. He's the co-author of Scoreboard Baby, a story of college football crime and complicity. He's an investigative reporter for the Seattle Times, and his co-author, Nick Perry, is an Associated Press correspondent. Their Seattle Times expose of the Washington Huskies won them journalism's highest honor, the George Polk and the Michael Kelly Awards for the fearless pursuit and expression of truth. The world-class job of reporting resulted in the book of, again, Scoreboard Baby. Ken, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael Ray. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let me ask you this. When was it that you first saw a problem or just got a hint that there was a problem there that you had to take a look at?
Well, actually, I started looking into it well after the actual season had been played. I started looking at it back in 2007 because I had seen a newspaper column that had mentioned a lawsuit that had been filed against the University of Washington and against a football player from the 2000 team. The column said that there had been a lawsuit accusing the player of rape and accusing the university of not holding the player accountable for it. And what caught my eye was it said the lawsuit had been settled on terms that were confidential. And I figured since the University of Washington is a public institution, if it had been settled, it was worth finding out what the settlement terms were and what had actually happened in the underlying litigation. So I started looking into that one player, and the story just kind of grew or developed from there.
See, I think it's interesting when you, most people don't think about this, but right at the top of your press release, college football is a big business, a gridiron, nonstop moneymaker with national reputations and billions, billions of dollars at stake. And really, no wonder college football programs are fraught, quote unquote, with scandal. When you're talking about that kind of money, old school, whatever goes right out the window. And all of a sudden, the underlying motives are completely different.
It is. It's a couple of things. Money is one element, certainly. And you're right. It's billions of dollars when you look at it collectively. The other element is emotion. Sports does weird things to people, does weird things to all of us. You know, we get so tied up in it that sometimes we lose that true north on our moral compass. And I think that's what happened in Seattle in 2000. We became so tied up in the Huskies that season that we kind of lost our way in terms of what was really most important.
Yeah, and very interesting, because when you're dealing with a lot of the college football players, you're dealing with kids that they go right out of high school and they go into college, and some of them go on to professional sports. There's that element of growing up that they miss. All of a sudden, these kids can do no wrong. They're the heroes. Everybody looks up to them. They're the champions and so on and so forth. And truly, they're everyday people with problems like everybody else has, with the exception of it's expanded. Because in the back of their minds, they are who they are, and they can't do anything wrong.
It's true. I actually think that there are extraordinary demands made of student-athletes. They're expected to be full-time students. They're also expected to really commit to the athletic program, and that's really time-consuming. A lot of these students come to the university without the kind of academic grounding that their classmates have, so they're kind of playing catch-up in the classroom.
Sure.
At the same time, the athletic department is asking them to study the playbook, show up for practice, hit the weight room, all of those things, and they're always receiving skewed messages. You know, we write about how the university wanted these players to remain academically eligible, obviously, but I don't know how much the university cared about what actual education they were getting. You know, they were steered to the easiest classes that the university had to offer. If they were in danger of flunking out, they're taking sexuality in Scandinavia. They're taking paper science, which is not science on paper, it's the science of paper. They had all of these classes lined up that the students knew about, that if they were in danger of falling below that 2.0 GPA, they would go to those classes, get a good grade, and bolster their GPA so that they could continue to play.
Sure, and moving it farther than that, back to they can do no wrong, quote-unquote, take care of the kids. Your words now. Judges, administrators look the other way to keep these athletes on the field and in the game. There's another problem. They're no matter, again, what they do, I know there's a lot of pressure on them, but still, some of the things, some of the felonies, some of the things that they get involved with, it's okay because when it comes down to it, nobody's going to penalize them for it. And there is a mindset that it's very hard to overcome.
It is, and at times it was shockingly explicit. There was one player on the team who was sentenced to 30 days in jail, but the judge wrote in her sentencing order to be served after football season. Mm. What kind of message does that send? There was another player who had an extensive history of domestic violence. He goes before a judge in a case where he's accused of punching his wife in the nose and breaking her nose. And what does the judge want to talk about at the hearing? He talks about the previous year's game at Notre Dame. He talks about the benefits of redshirting. He talks about weightlifting. You know, he holds a conversation that's more suited to a sports bar than to a courtroom. And again, if you're a student athlete hearing that, what are you taking from this? You know, you're probably taking that you're different, you're special, and that the rules that apply to the rest of us don't necessarily apply to you.
Now, by the way, when you and I'm looking at this, I'm listening to you very closely, and know what your background is. When you truly get involved with this, that's got to be scary, especially for the two of you. You're going to open up to the public what nobody wants opened up. You're going to make, even though we know, you're going to expose it. You exposed it. That had to be, quote-unquote, gutsy to do because of the backlash, the potential backlash.
You know, we at the paper, we knew that we were playing with fire. People take sports seriously, and that 2000 Husky team is really a treasured memory for the city of Seattle. And Seattle doesn't have a lot of great sports memories. We haven't done real well on the playing field in most of our sports. So here we had a team that prevailed, that won the Rose Bowl, did it in highly dramatic fashion, had a lot of really likable players like Marcus Tuiasosopo on the team. And we're telling this untold story about all this ugliness that happened off the field. So, yeah, we did anticipate blowback, and we received it. You know, for example, there was one sports talk show that was giving out the number on air to cancel your subscription. You know, there were a lot of critical comments written on fan blogs and on different online posts. But it was balanced out. There were a lot of other people who said that the stories really made them rethink their own views towards sports and whether or not they need to get their priorities back in order.
Did it make a dent? And when I say that, Ken, do you think changes will come, or do you think the exposure's there, billions of dollars, as you said, collectively, that's the key word, collectively, billions of dollars that are exchanged back and forth, that are made from the games, et cetera, or do you think they'll get excited about it and then it'll get quiet and they go back to business as usual?
That's always hard to measure, but I was gratified by the response of the university. After we published Scoreboard Baby, the University of Washington was asked on a couple of occasions to respond to what was in the book. And they gave a statement to the Chronicle of Higher Education and to another publication. And in both instances, the university said that when they look back on that 2000 season, they realized that there was a collective failure, you know, that the faculty failed, the coaches failed, the athletic department failed, and even beyond that, if you go beyond the university walls, the community failed, from the prosecutors to the judges to the media. And what the university said was that they were determined to do better, that they were going to learn the lessons to be gleaned from that season, and that they were going to do better going forward, and they have. The new coach, Steve Sarkisian, has kicked a number of players off the team for getting in trouble off the field, for violating team rules, including some players who were really valuable to the team. But as you're saying, Michael Ray, our memories are short, and it's easy to slip back into bad habits. So it'll be interesting to see what the situation is 5 years from now.
Okay, let's say we pick the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Ken, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael Ray, get that I didn't have before? What's the essence of what I get to walk away with?
That a lot of times the problems that we complain about are problems that we all share in common. You know, the book is really about collective complicity and about how all of us, from the university to the student athletes to our law enforcement agencies to the fans in general, played a part in what happened during that 2000 Husky season, and how what happened here in Seattle, you can find all over the country. You can find the same kinds of stories in Columbus with Ohio State. You can find it at the University of Miami. You can find it at Penn State. You know, a lot of times with sports, we simply lose our way, and we complain about boosters and the NCAA and everything else. But a lot of times the problems start closer to home.
You know, by the way, if we really look at this, yes, we can see it through a lot of the different sports throughout the country, but you can also see it in the culture, the society which the culture nurtures and creates. But you can see it in government, you can see it in business, and not getting political. But if you take a look at it, it can't just be in one spot. Even if the sports are exciting and as addictive as they are, it can't be just zeroed into one particular spot and put off in a corner. If they get away with it, it's because this is the way we look at life in the country today. So it's not just the sports, it's the entire way that we live today. And I'm glad you exposed it, because maybe somebody else will look at it with a broader viewpoint and say, well, if it's happening here, where else is it happening?
Right, and I think the answer is it's happening in a lot of places. Yeah. Right, I think a lot of Division I programs would have similar stories told if somebody went and did background searches on the entire roster of a team. I don't think that what happened in Seattle in 2000 was unique in that sense.
No, and go into, it doesn't matter, Republican, Democrat, that's not where I'm at. But go into Congress today, go into the Senate today, you got the same exact thing. It is no different. If you tell the story and you change the characters, you find the same thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, totally across the board. Okay, so the message of the book is what? What do we do to fix all this?
Well, I think we have to understand that when we're watching a game on Saturday afternoon, it doesn't extend to when we go into work on Monday. We need to keep the courtroom and the playing field separate, and we have to understand that it's just a game. And that, you know, once we lose sight of that, that's when all of these other things take place. And I think the NCAA is going to have its hands full with trying to address this culture of corruption that's taking place in sports. They're acknowledging it. In fact, the Division I Board of Directors met today and passed a number of reform measures, you know, directed at trying to shore up all of these problems that are popping out in college sports. But the NCAA has a long ways to go, and we need to participate in that.
Oh, by the way, I think my own personal opinion is if you took Scoreboard Baby and you sent it to every one of the universities, you sent it to the presidents of the universities, and you sent it to everybody that had some kind of a handle on the operation of the university, if they read it loud and clear, they know that, quote-unquote, if they do it, there's going to be an exposure someplace, because if it happened once, it can happen again.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of faculty members would tell you that. The book's received a terrific reception at other universities across the country. And I think it's because people see the parallels and they know that what happened here has happened there. You know, you just substitute a different name in, and in some cases, a different crime.
Yeah, makes all the sense in the world. Ken Armstrong, we've got to go. Do you have a website we can find you at, get the book, get more information?
I do. The book's website is scoreboardbaby.net, and it can also be found on Amazon.
Okay. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us. I think that's a great job, because it's an exposure that had to happen sooner or later, and I'm glad you guys got at it.
Great. Thanks, Michael Ray. Really appreciate it.
Good night.
Okay, good night.
But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is
a wrap.
Out as friends. You're
tears and laughter will linger after. They've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again. And the evening were